At Care Heating and Cooling, we put you first. You are the reason we're open 7 days a week and why it's easy to schedule service at careheatingandcooling.com. Your safety is why we check every gas furnace for carbon monoxide. And it's because of you that our techs are paid to fix your furnace, not sell you a new one. So it's no surprise that last year, Care was awarded a BBB Torch Award for Ethics, because at Care, we're committed to doing business right. Call Care at 1-800-COOLING when you need a company you can trust.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
Hello there, cultists. Another month, another episode of Cult Classics, here to brighten your day. And can you believe how quickly this year is flying by? Well, don't worry, we're going to hold back the passage of time because we've got a great one for you today. And instead of moving forward at a breakneck pace, we're going back to the 60s for our first official Toho Kaiju review. But we don't want to be predictable here on Cult Classics, we're not going straight to You Know Who, that'll come later. Instead, we're going to take an in-depth look at an underrated but highly regarded 24-carat certified gold standard cult classic. It's the 1966 kaiju epic War of the Gargantuas. Not heard of it? Shame on you. Go and watch it, and then come back to us. For the rest of you who know just how good this one is, over the next hour we'll be taking our customary dive into the movie, and hopefully we'll make it through without the words getting stuck in our throat. As always, I'm DK, your host on these little journeys into the past. I'm not an expert critic, just an enthusiastic guy who loves his movies. And as always, I'll not be alone for this trip. Joining me today is who is now becoming quite the semi-regular on the show. And let's be honest, I couldn't think of anyone more deserving of being on this one. You last heard him on last season's Black Hole review, but this time we're going right into his wheelhouse. It's the Kaiju Whisperer himself, Nige.
Hey, how we doing?
I'm all right, mate. And how are you?
Yeah, I'm really good, thank you. Yeah, really good.
Cool. How does it feel to be back, especially for something like this?
Oh, it's good. This is one of those films that you just have to love. Or hate, maybe in some people's case, I don't know, but yeah, this is a bit of a favourite, a really good talking point, I think, and yeah, excited to be back, to be honest.
Nice one. Well, normally at this point we bat backwards and forwards with our guests regarding their favourite cult movies, but being the regular on the show, we've been there and done that, so this time I'm coming to today's guest with this. Obviously, you're big into the kaiju scene. We've touched briefly upon it in previous episodes, but I wanted to know, what attracts you to the genre? I mean, where did it begin for you? What was your first kaiju movie? And what is it about the scene that so enthralls you? How did it all start?
I think the first time I really saw any kaiju films were when... Was it BBC Two or Channel 4 had a stint of them on TV? And I remember watching Destroy All Monsters and absolutely falling in love and falling about laughing at it. I couldn't believe what I was watching. I couldn't believe everyone was taking it serious. And I just wanted to know more. I wanted to, what is all this about? I wanted to watch more of these films. And the more I kind of started watching them, the more I realized there was actually a little bit more to it. And yeah, I still watch some just when I'm in that sort of mood where I just want to laugh and I just want to watch two guys in suits kick the hell out of each other. But other times, yeah, I genuinely enjoy these films as great films in some cases.
Nice one. Well, yeah, I mean, you obviously know your stuff regarding the field. So, you know, the next thing I'd like to ask, what are your thoughts regarding the various attempts by Hollywood over the years to westernise the characters? I mean, I'm thinking specifically of Emmerich's Godzilla reboot, Del Toro's Pacific Rim, the, you know, the current legendary films. I mean, I guess you could even take it back to the UK's own, you know, Gorgo and the Danish American movie Reptilicus. I mean, is there anything there in your opinion? Any gems?
So the less said about the 96 Godzilla movie, the better. I'm just, if you didn't have the name Godzilla, fine. It's a big lizard in a city, cool. But it's not a Godzilla film. And I think even with some of the later Hollywood films, for myself, the thing that they always get wrong is when I watch a classic Toho kaiju movie, the monsters are almost seen as characters. And the director sees it as a character, and this character has an emotional sort of journey that they generally undertake in some of these films. Okay, may not be too deep, but they're definitely seen as characters. Whereas in the Western films, what I always find is it's almost just a monster. And I think they've tried. I think the Godzilla 2014 tried a bit more in that sort of stint. While it wasn't in any way like a Toho film, I think they got an awful lot right in that I really enjoyed. But since then, it's almost become more cartoony. And the last couple of films, I'm just not feeling excited about it like I was when, say, Godzilla Minus One appears. I'm drooling at the mouth waiting to see it. But when the Western film comes up, it just isn't really working for me. I think things like Gorgo and Reptilicus, they have a certain charm to them as well, as in some of the early Godzilla movies and the Toho movies. But yeah, no one really does it like Toho, I guess. So there's bits to like in the modern films, but I think there's an awful lot lacking, and it just doesn't have the same charm for me. I mean, what's your thoughts on that?
I guess it's kind of similar. I mean, it could be because I saw a lot of the Toho films when I was younger, so I have that connection to them. I can watch the Emmerich Godzilla. No. I've not watched the Monarch TV series, so I couldn't comment on that. But I do like the legendary ones, but they're a bit more of a spectacle, I guess. They don't have that, I guess you put it, you know, that Toho charm. They're okay, but they're kind of tentpole blockbusters. They come and go, and you don't really think that much of them. I mean, are there any of these attempts that does capture maybe that glimmer, that same spirit that you see in the Toho films, or do you think they're just missing the point, as it were?
I think it's spectacle over substance every time with the Western films. There's nothing for me that I can watch them and go, okay, yeah, that was all right. But they seem to be films that I never really return to. As I said earlier, I think when Toho and the Japanese make a kaiju movie, a lot of the time the kaiju has a real character to it, and they treat the monster as another character in the film rather than a background noise as a spectacle. And I think that's, for me, what is nearly always missing. I think Gargantua is a prime example of when Ishiro Honda made this. It is all about the characters. Both of the Gargantuas in the film are real characters. And they go on a journey, and you kind of really feel for them. Or, well, I did. So, yeah, I think, and I'd never really find that in any of the Western films. It's always at the monsters in the background as a spectacle, rather than you having sort of feelings or empathy towards it for any sort of reason.
Yeah. Now, I mean, obviously, you know, advances in special effects over the years, they can or some to look back on, you know, older classic movies with more of a dismissive eye. I mean, these films, by and large, you know, by Western audiences mainly, again, I'm probably generalising, don't shoot the messenger, but they are, you know, to some extent treated with disdain for their reliance on, you know, guys in rubber suits, which, I mean, I think it's unfair, personally, as for the time and the budget, they were kind of pioneering, as they were a social commentary in some respects.
There's guys in suits kicking the crap out of each other, and the effects, by today's standards, in a way, are shocking. But you actually look at the miniatures work, look at the craftsmanship involved. And Gargantua's is a prime example of that. The miniature work is absolutely stunning. And if you can get past the guy in suits, the one thing I always think about is, if they had a passion to make this monster movie back in the 50s as it was, and then in the 60s, 70s going forward, how else can you do it? How else can you basically make a giant monster movie back in the day other than plonk a guy in a rubber suit? And all right, you might look at Toe and think, you know what, guys, you could really do with replacing that suit, because some of the Godzilla films, he is looking a little bit shabby. But again, that's part of the charm of it in a way. You listen to the interviews of the guys that play the Godzilla in the suit, and they're so passionate about what they do. But in terms of which, you know, where to start, I think Ghidorah, the three-headed monster, Monster Zero, that for me would be a great place to start, because it's such a terrific film. I can't knock that. Absolutely brilliant.
Right. Well, I mean, the one we're looking at today, I mean, it's highly regarded by those that know it, but it's still, in my experience, very much an unknown for a mainstream audience, which is a shame. I mean, obviously they're familiar with some of the headliners, Godzilla, Gamera, etc. But, you know, I'm obviously speaking to you, being a connoisseur of this genre, do you have any personal recommendations, personal favourites?
I think it's one of those things that if Godzilla appeals to you, if the early Godzilla films kind of make you go, oh God, that is so cool, and it's funny cool, then you're going to love some of the Gamera films. All right, the first few are, I guess, even more ropey than some of the Godzilla films. But again, they take it so seriously, and you look at what happens, and it's like, wow, there's somebody stood behind a camera filming this. This is mad. But then if you see that and you love that, you can start looking at things like Ultraman, which has been a TV show there, which is obviously the several movies. They had a new series on Netflix recently, animated, that was absolutely fantastic and kept all the things that you love about it. Same with the Godzilla Singular Point animated. I know that didn't go down particularly well, but for me, as soon as I was watching it, it felt like that's a Godzilla. There's something that they caught in it that just made it feel right.
Cool. So, I mean, thanks for that. Bearing that in mind, what we're gonna do now is we'll jump straight into looking at today's movie. Mm-hmm. And what are the Gargantuas, or Duel of the Gargantuas, Frankenstein Monsters, Sander versus Gyra, depending on where you're located? It's mm-hmm. a 1966 movie, directed by Ishiro Honda, a Japanese-American co-production. It was released as it's still referred to, as a quasi-sequel to Frankenstein versus Baragon, or Frankenstein Conquers the World, again, depending on where you're located, stars mm-hmm. Russ Tamlin, who took over from Tab Hunter during production, as well as Kumi Mizuno and Kenji Sahara. It was the third and final collaboration between Toho and producer Henry G. Saperstein after Invasion of the Astro Monster and the aforementioned Frankenstein versus Baragon. Now, principal photography began in May 66 and wrapped in June 66, with effects photography concluding just a month later in July. It released in Japan on July the 31st, 66, followed by a theatrical release in the States on July the 29th, 1970, on a double feature with Monster Zero. Now, in the UK, where the film was titled Duel of the Gargantuas, both this and Monster Zero were intended to be released earlier. However, distributors didn't think that either film had potential until 1970, when Saperstein made a deal with Maron Films. Now, over the years since its release, it's been recognised as a cult classic, with notable fans including Tarantino, Del Toro, Nicolas Cage, Brad Pitt, who alleges it was the first movie he saw, and Tim Burton. And War of the Gargantuas, as always, is currently available on various streaming services, depending on your location, as well as being available on DVD and Blu-ray. Now, I'm going to hold my hands up to this one. I had no idea this even existed until recently. My significant other introduced me to this one during the pandemic. She'd actually grown up with this thing and loved it. And knowing, you know, I loved the Toho Godzilla movies, thought I'd like this one. So, I mean, I'll be honest. When she showed me the trailer, I really wasn't convinced. I thought it was going to be some cheap kaiju knockoff. But I have to say, it honestly blew me away when I first watched it. It's a really well done movie. Nice surprise, that. So I've got to ask, when did you first see this one? And what were your first experiences of it? Does it hold any special memories?
I think this is...
Rose is your name, but when you poop, it sure don't smell like roses. Your number two burns the hair in my nose. But we fought hand in paw. Now your poop don't stink at all. Now that the air is clear, I'll treasure your front and rear, my sweet rose.
Instantly neutralize poop stink with Poop Fighter from World's Best Cat Litter for the world's best cat.
One of those that the first time I saw it, when I compare this to, say, the Godzilla movies or the Gamera movies, it didn't grab me in the same way. It almost wasn't silly enough. I could look at some of the fights and didn't really see the barminess of some of the early Godzilla films in this film. It's only as I've come back to it and watched it again and again that it's almost not like a kaiju movie. It's kind of so serious in a way with the characters, and it's almost quite heartbreaking towards the end of the film, where the brother sacrifices himself for the other brother and so on. And it's generally quite a heartfelt film, which I think many of the kaiju films don't manage to do. I would look at it and say it's quintessential Ishiro Honda and what he was trying to do with films. You look at the sort of films he was making around that time, and the different things he was trying, and what Toho were trying with a lot of the films, in trying to broaden the appeal. They'd a couple of years previously done Mothra, trying to get women involved. This, for me, was a more serious take on the genre. And I think I saw it similar around the time that I first discovered the Godzilla films. But it's only in the last probably 10, 12 years that I've come back to this more and more, and appreciating the film just as a great film. And again, more on looking at some of the effects, some of the miniature work, actually some of the directing and the scenes and images that they have on the film. It's just a great film to watch, but it's not necessarily a beers with your mates sort of film. It's one that I sit and actually sit and I absorb. I let the atmosphere wash over me. And yeah, I watch it with quite a serious head on, I think.
Yeah, I have to admit, I did watch this obviously recently for the show. And I put it on, and it just feels incredibly short. I mean, it's your typical, you know, hour and change movie, but it just goes by at such a pace.
Yeah, it does.
I really enjoy it, and it's made such an impression on me. I mean, I'm guessing you've watched this, you know, relatively recently again, yeah?
Yeah, yeah.
Cool.
I watched the actual American dub, which I wouldn't recommend. I don't think that helps the film at all.
Which one is the American dub? Because I've watched the one which has Russ Tamlin's actual voice. Previously, I tried watching it on the video streamer Plex, and they dubbed Tamlin's voice also. Someone else had dubbed it. So which one was it that you'd seen?
I think the one I seen was with Russ Tamlin's original voice. Previously, I've seen one with the subtitles which I much, much preferred. The one with Tamlin's voice. Oh, no, it's... Oh, no. As it does with a lot of these films, when you get the dubbing on over the top, it almost becomes a completely different movie. And, I mean, Tamlin, well, I guess we'll get to that, but he's not very convincing. He doesn't look like he's really buying into the movie. His performance is pretty poor, I think, across the film. But I don't think it helps the film at all.
No. I mean, we're there, so we might as well bring it up. Apparently he was, you know, incredibly difficult to work with. From what I understand, he did pretty much the opposite of Honda's instructions and improvised his lines without Honda's approval. From what I understand, he was a bit of a prima donna. I mean, Saperstein himself, he says he was, you know, a pain in the ass. And I don't know. I mean, at the time, Tamlin said that he felt he'd never work again after this. And from what I understand, during the process of dubbing the film for American audiences, his audio track was lost, meaning that he had to redub all his lines, which, you know, people are saying that's why he sounds so disinterested. But because he was ignoring Honda's directions and he improvised much of his dialogue, he pretty much had to rely on his own memory and, you know, lip reading movements in order to redub it. And from what I can understand, you know, obviously he was tapped to be a great leading man in Hollywood, you know, after West Side Story and things like that. And he was, you know, he ended up refusing movie roles and a role in TV series Gilligan's Island. But he was unable to hold on to his position. And I'm not sure if that, I mean, obviously he's mellowed on the film over the years, but at the time he really didn't like it.
Well, I think it'll have been a typical West noise where they looked at the film and they thought, what is this about? I am far superior to this. But he just didn't understand Japanese culture. If you look at any of the sort of Toho films of the time, all the actors in all the films take it really seriously and they really try to give great performances. There aren't many, all right, there's odd, occasionally comic characters in them that it's there for light relief. But all the sort of prominent characters within kaiju films generally are done really, really seriously because they're trying to tell a serious story. His entire demeanor on the film is nothing like a typical Ishiro Honda scientist in one of his films. There's no energy to his performance. There's no directness. He doesn't grip you when he's speaking. And I get, I understand that he may go, you know what, this film, what am I doing on it? And it might just be a paycheck to him. But I always say, you know what, you're there to do a job. And he could have done something that would have really probably lasted beyond any other role that he's ever had. And his naivety has cost him dearly, because people look now and just think, you know what, you really didn't do a good job on that.
Yeah. I mean, I'm jumping ahead. I guess it could be considered feedback, but I do have to give a shout out to David Dela Cruz. He did post an awesome pic taken of himself at Burbank Monsterpalooza with Russ. And as I said in the group, David, I'm not envious at all, but that's a great photo. Thanks for that, man. And he does seem to have come around. But again, he kind of blew it at the time. And I'm not necessarily going to say it's because of this movie, but he's. I think Tamlin these days, like Travolta did when he came back and did Pulp Fiction, he's got that element of, I guess you could say, cool, you know, like Dennis Hopper did in his later years. And I'm not sure how often he'd like to be reminded of this. I mean, I'm sure when he comes to someone talking about West Side Story or Seven Brides for Seven Brothers, he'd much prefer those to be brought up rather than...
Yeah, I get that. I can see that.
So, I mean, you know, because we're on the subject of the actors, what do you think to the co-stars? I mean, you know, Kenji Sahara as Dr. Machida and, you know, Kumi Mizuno. What do you think to the co-stars, as it were, their performances?
In general, the acting is always good. If you watch any of the Toho films, particularly the Shiro Honda films, all the actors, they're really doing their best to sort of, right, here's a performance. And it's only what I think when you watch them in the original Japanese with the subtitles, you hear the voices that they're doing, you think, oh, actually, yeah, I get this. I'm buying into this guy. Unfortunately, when you watch it with a dub, some of the side characters come across as real Muppets because of the voice actor dubbing it in. But
yes,
the sort of acting across the board on most of the ones that I've seen is always really good. It's a little exaggerated sometimes, but I guess they're in a monster movie. But you can't say that anyone's not making an effort. And I think this one, because in essence, it is a serious film. Everyone is putting in a real serious performance, and they're making the effort that you hope they would.
Yeah. It's interesting what you say with regards to the dubbing. There were a couple of lines in there that were delivered, I'm not going to say comically, but it reminds you of other things. I mean, there is a point where one of the guys, one of the actors shouts out earlier in the movie, "Hey, you guys," and all it does is remind me of the Goonies. Yes. And yeah. towards the start, they're reporting on the fisherman that first encounters one of the gargantuas in the movie. And he says, comes in and he says, "How is he?" And he says, "The doctor says he can't tell yet." And all I'm expecting is, well, he can tell me, I'm a police officer. You know, it really has that airplane vibe about it almost, because as you say, they do act a little like Muppets. But I mean, with regards to the subtitled one, I understand that as well as this one, you went back and watched the Frankenstein versus Baragon to prepare. Is that right?
Yeah, I watched a little bit of that. I mean, it's something that, again, I go back to every now and again, put it on.
But see, what confuses me is this is the dubbed one is the version I first watched. And when I did start watching the Plex one, obviously there are certain scenes that are swapped and changed around a bit. I didn't have time to watch the Plex one in the end. But they refer to the monsters in that as, they do label them as Frankensteins. And so I guess you could look back and see the connection, and it gives an explanation. Whereas the dubbed one, it kind of just drops you in the deep end and expects you to take on board that, okay, these scientists were doing genetic experiments. It doesn't really give any kind of backstory other than the fact that, yeah, they were working with this gargantua, if that makes any sense. Watching the subtitled version and watching obviously the Frankenstein versus Baragon, is there more of a connection there? Is there more of a foundation?
There's a little, isn't there? I think there's a little bit more to take in, but again, it's quite tenuous. There are little references dropped in here, there, and everywhere, but you can watch either of these and not see the other one for some time, and it doesn't make any difference to the film at all. Like, the first one is more of a, it feels more of a classic kaiju movie, Frankenstein versus Baragon. I look at the Baragon suit now and I'm like, oh, that's a strange looking face. But yeah, you can watch the War of the Gargantuas without seeing Frankenstein versus Baragon. It doesn't make any difference whatsoever. You're not missing out on anything. And I think it's, the references are so slight in the film that you just kind of have to roll with it. Don't ask too many questions as you do with a lot of these films, and it's fine.
Yeah, there is an element of, you know, having to hand wave it away. As they would say on Mystery Science Theater, you should really just relax. I mean, as you mentioned, it you know, Nick Adams, I mean, he did star in Frankenstein, you know, Conquers the World, as you were, the loose prequel to this. So did you feel, performance-wise, obviously, it was a step down from Adams to Tamlin, yeah?
Oh, it's a huge step down. I think Tamlin's performance is just weak. There's no two ways about it. It doesn't. It never feels like he's really making an effort or even emoting. There's very little emotion comes from his character. I think Nick Adams has far more of that in what he tries to do. I think everything Ishiro Honda touched, you can. There's a certain quality and a charm to it. And I just wish, say, Tamblyn had seen that earlier in his career and kind of really bought into it and thought, you know what, I'm going to make an effort here. But he doesn't. It's a weak effort.
Yeah. I mean, speaking of Honda, apparently towards the end of 65, Toho informed him that his director's contract wouldn't be renewed. And then he'd need to speak with the producers about each assignment. And I think that's a bit of a, I don't know, it's a bit disrespectful in my, you know, in my opinion, but he seemed to suffer through it.
I think he's, if you look at his list of films, it kind of speaks for itself. And I guess that's the must have always been the movie industry. They'll sign him up for X number of films. Right, do those films next. If they perform really well, we'll sign you up for some more. If they don't, well, maybe we need a conversation. And some of the films certainly did reap in the money, whereas others, I guess for their time, they were quite forward-thinking. They were quite different. But the fact that they're still being watched now just speaks volumes. There are a number of films that come out in Hollywood that at the time don't make an impact, but go on to be.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Cult classics or just, yeah, you know, highly revered movies. The Thing being a prime example. And I think there's a lot of Honda's films that have that about them. They're just great films. And he did make some, you know, two or three great films around that sort of time. I mean, Matango is another one that's a little bit nuts, but it's wonderful.
Yeah, I mean, you know, he had several Godzilla films under his belt. You know, he got Rodan, Mothra, as you mentioned. So, but as you say, it's the nature of the business.
Yeah.
So, I mean, speaking of Godzilla, I mean, obviously, Haru Nakajima, who played Godzilla in 11 of his original 15s, is playing Gaira in this. And apparently it was his favourite Toho monster to play due to the flexibility of the costume, and he was able to emote better than, you know, obviously being locked away in a Godzilla suit.
Both the actors for both Sanda and Gaira both do a really good job. I mean, the makeup, I think, is pretty epic for the time. Gaira just looks absolutely horrific.
Yes.
But I think both of them do a great job. You can sense that emotion coming out of them, even though they're just there in whoever knows what sort of get-up, and they look absolutely horrific, but they both do a really good job.
Yeah, I as you mentioned earlier, it's they don't go into it tongue-in-cheek. It does take itself seriously. I think that's one of the things that I love about this. Everybody commits to, well, obviously notable exceptions, but everybody commits to it, and it comes across, you know, really well. Now, with regards to the writing, I didn't know this until, like, you know, researching the movie, but apparently the first appearance of the Mazer cannons, the weapons used in many of Toho Studios films, and in the real world, Mazer stands for microwave amplification by stimulated emission of radiation. And
of course it does.
Yes, going back to what you said earlier with the special effects, the miniatures, when they're unlocking these maser cannons and putting them into position in the first time, it looks beautiful. I think the production design on this, as you said earlier, yeah, people can be dismissive, but I think they're really selling the craftsmanship short, especially on movies like this, because I was just blown away by some of them, you know, and even with things like, I guess, you know, me and you are old style retro gamers. We played on Spectrums and Commodore 64. In, for want of a better term, the parallax scrolling as the military are going by with the helicopters in the background,
yeah,
the tanks in the foreground. I think it just looks, if that, you know, if I can put it into words, which obviously I can't. I mean, what do you think? I think they still really hold up, well, considering what type of movie it is.
The effects across the board, I think, are just fantastic. If you look at some of the miniature work across this sort of kaiju genre for years and years, it's always been pretty good. But this is a real standout example. If you do take your time on, say, a second watch to actually look at some of the buildings, some of the model work, it's really exemplary. And just trying to imagine how much time must have gone in to do that. And again, if you reflect it forward, I think in that day, the industry was full of craftspeople that clearly had a passion about what they were doing. And their attention to detail is phenomenal. And again, I think some of that's been lost in the world of CGI. You don't get that same level of craftsmanship. You get a similar level of detail with the CGI. And I think it is coming on leaps and bounds in terms of looking at buildings and how they explode and collapse and so on. But this is 1966, and yeah, it's absolutely phenomenal to see it. Two guys in a suit run around a city and kick the crap out of it. It just looks fantastic.
Yeah. I mean, again, Western audiences, there is a tendency to laugh at the model making for the buildings. But as you say, when they are collapsing, and they are collapsing in a way that is consistent with real-world architecture, there is so much detail put into the effects on this thing. And yeah, it's old, and in some respects it's not dated. But when you look at the period, I mean, 66, we're in the same generation kind of thing. So in over in the States, you've got the original Star Trek series. In the UK, you've got the classic Doctor Who series. And I love both of those, but the effects, when you compare them, and yeah, obviously this is a movie compared to a TV series, but you know, the budget and all that entails. But I think the miniature work is leaps and bounds ahead of, you know, what was being accepted effects-wise in the West.
Yeah, I think we always make kind of... we always give a lot of patience when we're watching old movies in terms of the special effects. We kind of go, well, it was a long time ago, blah, 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 so I can put up with this. But I don't think you even have that mindset, or certainly I don't, when I watch something like this, because it is that good. When I watch classic Doctor Who, I look and I go, wow, yeah, that is a guy with bubble wrap on his hand. Or it might, you know, it's in here, you just don't see, you just think, wow. And you almost forget that it's something that someone's made. It generally looks like there's real buildings falling. All right, then, yes, yeah, you've got a guy in a suit collapsing on top of it. But it is exemplary stuff. It really is top draw, the effects in this. And it just adds to that immersion. It really does.
Yeah. I mean, I should point, I mean, special effects, Eiji Tsuburaya, Japanese, he was a director, filmmaker, and cinematographer. He was co-creator of Godzilla and Ultraman. He's considered one of the most important and, you know, obviously influential figures in the history of cinema, known as the father of tokusatsu, live-action films or TV programs that make heavy use of practical special effects. He was a pioneer and introduced several technological developments in film productions. And one of the things that, again, going back to what you said earlier with regards to the miniatures, and I didn't know until researching, The scene where they do attack Gaira in the mountains, and you know they launch an offensive at it. And I'm digressing here, but the special effects when they're attacking him, I love that they give him that battle damage. I don't think at the time you would have seen that in anything in a Western movie. But regardless, I mean, it was. I loved the fact that during that fight they uproot trees, and but because of, you know, it's the real world, they're not going to know where they're falling in to general, you know, in general terms. They needed to create miniatures for the trees with roots so that they would actually look like trees. But because they didn't know exactly where they were falling, every single tree seen in that scene had detailed roots hidden under the ground. And I just think that's...
It's attention to detail again, isn't it?
It is.
It's just different league. You just have to admire it. You can't do anything else other than think, wow, there's a lot of people put a lot of work into this.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I will say that, and this is my media literacy as far as it goes, tripping me up. But sometimes when I do look at the monster design, I'm instantly reminded of Oddbod and Oddbod Jr. from Carry On Screaming. But that is...
Yeah, it is.
And it, again, it's weirdly enough, that's the second thing in two episodes that remind me of Carry On Screaming. So that obviously played a bigger part of my life. But yeah, there's the scene in the mountains that we were talking about. I've seen the movie before. I'd seen the trailer. I know, you know, the gist of the thing. But when they're attacking the gargantua, and then the second one turns up, it still kind of makes my stomach lurch, even though I know what's going to happen. I can just imagine audiences in the cinema back when this was released, you know, not knowing anything about it as such. But when they go, there's another one, there's a second gargantua, and it comes around the corner of the mountain. I just think it's really impressive.
Yeah, it's definitely one of those films that you need to go in with a certain mindset. I don't think you can go into this one with a let's watch a giant monster movie. You go into this one to go, we're going to watch a film.
Yes.
And let's just sit down, get his head in the right place and watch it. And just, I guess from our perspective, we would always go admire it because there's so much about this that's worth watching. There are a couple of bits that are cringe. I'm sure we'll get onto one of them in a moment. but it is just a great film to watch. But you have to go into it with a mindset of wanting to watch a really good film rather than wanting to watch, let's watch a giant monster movie.
Yeah. Yeah. So let's get to that cringe. I take the fact that the version you watched also has the Kip Hamilton singing. Is that right?
Yep.
Yeah. Yep. So I didn't know this. Kip Hamilton was actually the sister-in-law of Carol Burnett.
I did not know that.
Yeah. So just for audiences, the song that Kip Hamilton sings in the nightclub is called The Words Get Stuck in My Throat, also known as Feel in My Heart. It was written by H.B. Barnum, originally performed in 1965 by Trini Lee Kearney on her album Romantic Inception. And since then, it's been later covered by Devo. So, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. It was also... It is. It was also featured later on in the animated series Scooby-Doo Mystery Incorporated in 2010 in an episode called Battle of the Humongonauts, which was obviously a homage to this.
Yeah, but very much.
Yeah, but it is cringe, but I can't help but love the cheesiness of it all.
I'm going to disagree with you on this. I hate it. I hate everything about it. It annoys me that it's played the entire song. Instead of it being background noise, the film kind of pauses while she goes on and on. And it gets It's like my favorite quote from the film, not because it's a great quote. It's just because it's seared into my brain. And once you hear it, it takes ages to get it out of your head. And it's horrible. I hate it. It's terrible.
Oh, man. Are you going to be... Yes. Are you going to be disappointed listening back to this episode? Yes. It does. Maybe it's just because I'm a lover of cheese in general, but it does kind of pause the action. It does kind of take a break from the serious of the film. And I get where they were coming from. They wanted to get something, I guess, you know, hip at the time in there.
It's not, she even sings it in the key of awful. It's
oh, it is terrible, isn't it?
It's like, shut up. And when Gargantua turns up and then, you know, tries to eat it, I'm like, yes. Yes.
Yeah. It's not often that you do watch one of these movies and actually root for one of the cast being dispatched in such a god awful way. But you see that and you just think, oh, just do it. Just, yes.
End the song now.
Yes. There's nothing, I don't think we can add anything else to that. And I don't think we want to dwell on it anymore. Yes, the soundtrack itself, Akira Ifukube, who's best known for composing several entries in the Godzilla franchise, in as well as developing the titular monster's roar. And I think, again, that little misstep aside, using Kip Hamilton, I think the soundtrack for this is really good also.
I think it has its moments, definitely. It's very much his sound. It sounds very much like a lot of the other kaiju films that he did. I'm not mad keen on some of it. It's not generally a style of score that really floats my boat. I think there are certain things where, like, you hear the Godzilla theme and you think, that's almost like an iconic piece of music. And whenever you hear that, you immediately think of the big G. In this, what I found once I returned to it two or three times is I never really recalled what the score was. I heard the music, but I didn't really, none of the themes really hit and stuck. The only piece of music that stuck was You Know What.
Yeah, which isn't a great thing to be left with, let's be honest.
No.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
The job, in essence, it works, but it doesn't, again, it doesn't stand out. It's not a piece of music I would listen to in its own right, put it like that.
No. It's not memorable, and it's not something that you would automatically return to. But I think that's indicative of the movie as a whole, not in a sense of quality, because I think this is just up there with some of the best, but they never really kind of return to it. You know, I'm going on to the legacy now. They do kind of admit, they kind of incorporate into the larger Godzillaverse. I mean, in 2002's Godzilla against Mechagodzilla, and a year later in Godzilla Tokyo SOS, they do refer to the Gargantuas. So it does take place in the same universe. But for a lot of the time, you know, obviously when you have Rodan appearing in his movie, and Mothra appearing in her movie, and then they're brought into the Godzilla films, and, you know, there's a mashup, there's a general crossover kind of vibe. But other than this, it doesn't seem to be looked at as part of the family, for the most part, if that makes any sense. And I wondered what you thought.
Very much so, yeah. I think it's, yeah, but I think in a way, and it's nice that it's part of the kind of the monsterverse as such, but it is and does feel like a very different film. It might be interesting to see Sandra or Gyra, you know, running up to Godzilla. But I always look at them and think, you know what, no matter who they take on, they're going to get battered. Their special ability is running around, eating people and smacking other gargantuas. They kind of, they're lovely in their own right. I just don't see them standing up to these. I don't really know where they fit in the world as such.
Yeah. I mean, I do like that it's incorporated, and the nerd in me would like to see more of him in the Monsterverse itself. But as you say, once you get past that initial introduction and where they come from, how they act and things like that, there's not a great deal that you can go for them with, other than for them to be, I would say, the MMA fighters of the Monsterverse. It's, you know, if they were in, say, Destroy All Monsters, they'd just be in one corner of the island just smacking each other about. And I think that would
be
pretty
too
much
human,
it.
If I'm honest, DK. I think the characters, because they're kind of ground in emotional background, I think I'd look at Sander and Sander getting absolutely battered, you'd be like, oh, I really, really feel sorry for him, but I don't think there's anything he can do about it. So I kind of just feel they get a little bit, they just get lost. And they are very, very human, which a giant human kind of running around just doesn't quite, I think it detracts from some of the other monsters if they're in the same scenes. I think they'd have to do some work nowadays on the look of them for them to fit into a new Godzilla movie as such.
Yeah. I mean, that's one of the questions I was going to ask. I mean, it's over 50 years old now, this thing. But, you know, as we've seen over recent years, Kaiju Field seems like fair game to studios. Is it surprising to you that there hasn't been at least an attempt to revive this for a modern audience, especially considering the number of, you know, the high profile fans that, you know, that it has in the industry?
Yeah, I'm amazed it's not been, someone's not reattempted it or done something with it. I'm sure if they redid it now, it'd be a very different film to War of Gargantuas, but I'm really surprised it's not been picked up. And whether that's down to Toho not releasing the license for it or whatever it might be, I don't know. But it's, yeah, it, with everything that goes off, I don't know why they aren't taking more of the monsters out of the sort of Toho universe and bringing them forward to some of the American audiences. I guess it'll come down to licensing fees and so on and so forth, but there are so many that are really ripe for that. And there must be a place there, Gargantua, somewhere.
Yeah. I mean, it has inspired others' work. I mean, manga artist Hajime Isayama cited this movie as an inspiration for Attack on Titan. And Tarantino, I mean, we said earlier that he was a fan. Kill Bill Volume 2, it has a miniature shot of Tokyo made specifically for the film. And the fight scene between Uma Thurman and Daryl Hannah, Tarantino dubs that the War of the Blonde Gargantuas. So, yes, it does have these fans, but is there an essence, do you think, of maybe, yes, they love it, but are they also a little embarrassed by it?
I guess that depends on who you ask. I think for me, like, War of the Gargantuas is a perfect Guillermo del Toro movie because of how he makes films. He doesn't just generally make big monster movies. His films have a certain look and a feel to them. And I could imagine him taking this and making an incredible movie out of it, but almost isolated from other things. I think some Western directors and audiences would look and go, yeah, I don't want to get involved with that. But I think if it's made in the right way, it would soon get people coming back on board and going, actually, yeah, I like that from the start. And you get all those sort of plaudits then. So, yeah, I think I'm always cautious of saying, yeah, I hope they do make a film of this, because the number of films that I watched, I think, wow, they've killed that. But it's, yeah, I think if anyone was to make a gargantuous film, I'd love a Guillermo del Toro to pick that up and go, right, there you go, dude. You've got these two creatures. What can you do with that? And where you would take the design, I don't know. And where the story would end up, I just think, you know what, he's got the right kind of emotion in his films that would really work for a gargantuous film. Yeah.
Do you think it deserves its cult classic status? I mean, I know it's kind of like, you know, teaching your grandmother to suck eggs at this point, because obviously it is, otherwise we won't be talking about it. But you personally?
Yeah, I think it's one of those films that if you're one of those guys that goes, you know what, I'm really getting into these monster movies. I'm seeing different things every time I watch them. I'm hearing the score. I'm really appreciating the special effects. This is one of those kaiju films that I think you need to watch. It's that good. I don't think it's one that you're necessarily going to return to that often, but I think you will come back to it and you'll watch it every time and think, wow, this is a really good film. But like I say, you just have to have a certain mindset. So absolutely, I think it is a cult classic, and it should have a bigger audience. But maybe, I don't know, maybe a lot of the audience nowadays, you know, maybe they're not able to appreciate it, or just maybe it's not their cup of tea.
That's fair enough. Before we move on, do you think there's anything that we might have missed during the discussion that warrants attention?
I just think, no, I think there's like I said, there's a lot of scenes that are really great on the screen that just look lovely. You're kind of happy. Oh, I could pause that, print it out, put it on my wall. There are several images like that. I think there's some great quotes that you hear on the film, particularly in the American dub, and just some of the awful lines that are on there. I think we covered the sort of basics. I think if we've done anything, I just hope we leave people going, all right, I need to go watch that film.
Yeah. This is what I love about doing these episodes. When I talk to someone that's generally, you know, genuinely enthusiastic about it, it makes me want to go and watch it again. And I love that. And I don't get that a lot with, I guess you could say, modern movies. They kind of leave me cold. But when I speak to someone that knows their stuff and they, you know, they're genuinely enthusiastic about what we're talking about, it really gets me a fuse to go and experience it again.
Yeah. Any sort of passion that if somebody's talking from a passionate perspective, it's so much easier to listen to them. And if we can put a little bit of that across about what we feel about these films, and people go, you know what, I'll give War of Gargantua's a watch, then all good. We've done his job.
Yeah. Just kind of plug your ears when you get to the Kip Hamilton scene.
Absolutely. Just fast forward, do whatever you need to do, make it go away.
So what I'm going to do now, I'm going to come straight in and ask, who's your MVP in this? Any character or portrayal that stands out in this one for you?
Gaira. Green Gargantua. That's my MVP in this. Green Gargantua. Gets absolutely battered so many times. Looks absolutely horrific, but is just wonderful. I love it.
Weirdly enough, I was gonna say Sander. So we've got his own little war going on here. I love the little character arc that he has. He comes in, he tries to help, he tries to convince Gaira, and it's just not working. So yeah.
I think I win because Gaira, if you remember the airport, picks up a woman, puts her in his mouth. Sun appears, he looks absolutely startled, so spits her out onto the floor, runs and jumps into the sea. Beat that.
Yeah, all right, fair enough. So, yeah, do you have any kind of particular favourite thing from this in general, be it dialogue, scene, you know, makeup, effects, anything that you watch it and every time you watch it, you just go, ooh, this is good?
It's just a nice movie to watch in a way. I don't watch it with the same mindset as I watch some of the early Godzilla films. I watch this, I love looking at the forests and the cities and the effects. And I love the parts where the brothers start arguing and they're fighting, and in the end he comes back and saves him. I like an awful lot about this movie.
Cool. From my own part, I'm going to seem incredibly shallow now after that, so thank you for that. But I'm going to go with the mountain scene. I think the attention to detail, the battle, and, you know, just when you think it's all over, the other Gargantua shows up, Sander comes on the scene. Every time it gets to that, I'm just transfixed. And from that point on, I'm just completely sold on the premise. Mm. So yeah, those are our likes. But what about you guys out there? What did you think? As usual, we put out some requests for feedback on our Silver Screen group page, as well as on social media in general. And we had some good feedback for this one. So once again, I'm going to go over to our new feedback expert, the good lady Vianne, to see what your opinions are on this one. So Vianne, what do you have for us this time around?
Hey DK, so, you know, when it comes to kaiju movies, Godzilla's where it's at for me, but it does look like people have a lot to say about this one. So Davey Walters, he says, one of the best from Toho. Just learned it was a sequel to Frankenstein Conquers the World, too. Made it even better. Now that sounds like something I'd be interested in, Frankenstein Conquers the World, but that'd be a first one for me. David Paquette, oh man, this was one of my absolute favorites as a kid. I'll never forget how nightmarish it was when I first saw that shot of the green Gargantua looking up from under the water at the men on the boat. Some people fear the shark from Jaws is lurking under the ocean waves, but for me, it's the green Gargantua. The other thing that creeped me out was the sounds it would make. Not just that piercing shriek, but that weird ch-ch noise. Still gives me goosebumps. About 8 or 9 years ago, I purchased the Japanese Blu-ray from Amazon in Japan. I had an HD projector and wanted to finally see this film in all its widescreen glory on my 12-foot-wide living room wall. Well, that does sound fun. Well, it was great to finally view the film in its original aspect ratio, but the blue screen type of effects became so apparent when viewed that large. I think I prefer watching it on a television screen. As a monster movie, I definitely give this 5 stars. It's been a few years, so I think I'll watch it this weekend. What I like about this review is this really highlights the importance of sound effects and sound editing in films, which can really make or break a lot of things, but particularly monsters when we start getting into horror and terror in film. So I'm glad he pointed that out. What else? Bob Seymour. There are many iconic scenes in this movie. The very beginning when Gaira fights the giant octopus is excellent. Obviously, the airport scene is gruesome even today. My favorite scene is when Gaira is almost killed by the master cannons right before Sanda shows up to save him. The effects actually hold up pretty well for being 55 plus years old. The performances are better than average. And again, we have somebody bringing up a really great point here. Practical effects, in my opinion, will always outlive CGI. CGI dates something way faster than practical effects. In my opinion, there's just a reality that's lacking. There's a depth that's lacking in CGI. So I do love a good practical effect. They always stand the test of time. Anyway, let's see what Todd Rice, as a sequel to Frankenstein Conquers the World, it's awful. With the original English dubbing with Russ Tamblyn, it's a masterpiece. One of Honda's best films. Clyde Walker thinks it's the best monster movie ever made. Let's see. Ernest Hudson, War of the Gigantus? Oh God, I hope I'm saying that right. Is my all-time favorite Toho movie. It needs an origin remake. I would request Takashi Yamazaki, the director who made Godzilla Minus One. John Philip Cole, my favorite kaiju, incredible effects, great soundtrack. Leon A. Vega Jr., my favorite non-Godzilla Toho movie, love it with a heart. This seems to be a lot of people's favorite. Michael Foster thinks it's one of the scarier Toho movies. This is one of my top 10 movies of all time, he says. Cody Ray Parker, 5 stars. Terrified me as a child. Still have my, I assume that's a DVD, and watch at least once a month. Favorite moments are Gaara staring through the ocean water looking up at the fishermen. I'm seeing a recurring theme here. And coming through the fog when people are hiking, not to mention the live kill. Pete Farrow, why the monsters were never put into rotation in future movies is beyond me. Perhaps a remake of this classic film. Could you imagine if the new Kong vs. Godzilla movie due out in April had them fighting the gargantuas? It would sell out in every theater. Lewis Davies, one of his favorite movies. Kyle Beatty, love this movie, saw it again over Christmas. I loved watching it as a kid, and I still do as an adult. Oh gosh, lots of feedback on this one. Jeffrey Davis, how much do I love this movie? Let's just say the words get stuck in my throat, wink, laugh, heart, heart. So that's probably a reference to something I don't know about. Oh yeah, it must be because Angel Ramos, scariest part was when that white chick was singing on the rooftop. Because the words get stuck in my throat. I really wanted Green Gargantua to eat her. Devo did a great cover of the song in the 70s. Great movie. 5 stars. Remember watching this when it came out. I love that movie. 4 stars. Good movie. The best Honda film, in my opinion, according to Ron Munster. Dirk Schrank. I have seen it, and I can understand it. Why it's one of Quentin Tarantino's favorites. And of course, we can see a lot of that kind of influence on Tarantino's films. Gosh, just a lot of really, really good feedback. This seems super popular. Another, the airport attack scene. I love this movie. We watched it in the 70s. 5 stars. Awesome. So looks like this is a big hit. I would be surprised if not everybody gave this 5 out of 5 stars here, even the people who didn't rank it, because they're really loving this one. So I guess I know what I'm going to be watching later. Anyway, back to you, DK.
Thanks for that, Vianne. We'll hopefully hear from you again next episode. And as always, thank you to you out there for letting us know your thoughts. Once again, apologies if we didn't manage to read yours out, but we do go through every piece of feedback. I'd like to give a special shout out this month to the War of the Gargantua's page on Facebook, who gave us not only so many cool bits of feedback, but prompted some of the members to jump in and join us over on the Silver Screen page. So thank you for that. And if you do want to check it out and discuss the movie with fellow fans of this one, I'll post the link to the group in the description. And remember, if there's something you think either our audience or we here today missed during the recording of this episode, don't hesitate to get in touch on our social media and let us know what you think. So now we reach the moment of truth, our final thoughts and score out of 5 for this one. If you're new to the show, we each give our own conclusions and our personal ranking, which will give us a combined total. So without further ado, I'm going to go straight over to you, Nigel, for this one. What are your final thoughts on this, buddy?
Final thoughts is that if you are a fan of kaiju movies, this is a must watch. I don't think it's one that you will come back to time after time, but I think you will appreciate this for so many different reasons. If I was to give it a score, I'm going to say 3.5, 4, only because it's not one that I come back to time after time.
All right. Which is it going to be?
4.
A 4. It's Kip Hamilton, isn't it? That's what did it for you.
Yep, absolutely.
Okay, I'll come to mind. I find it hard to believe that I didn't know about this one until a couple of years ago. It seems to be so well known in certain circles, but to a general audience, tumbleweeds. I'd never even heard of it, but it blew me away when I saw it, and truth be told, it's done that every time since. It's easy for a modern audience to dismiss these things as lightweight, but Gargantua's is a testament to the attention to detail within these movies, both the acting, the story, the effects. I mean, the acting's not perfect, I'll be honest. It's serviceable. I do have a tendency on occasion to give Tamlin an automatic pass because it's Tamlin, but he does, you know, kind of meander in this. The effects, though, for this time, they're great stuff, regardless what anyone says, and I still get a genuine shiver watching this play out. There's always the worry that when you don't have that connection to seeing something at an early age, you lose that chance. That when in the opening credits roll, it could drag, something that has, on occasion, happened with other kaiju movies, personally. But, as I mentioned earlier, this one flies by. It grabs my attention every time, and not only is it impressive, It's I'm going to say it's fun. It's not lightweight fun, but it's fun. And it's yet another thing that I have to thank my my significant other for, because if not for her, I probably still wouldn't have known about this. And I'm going to give it a 4.5 out of 5. So, yeah.
What's it going to be? So, 4 or 5?
It's just going to be 4.5. I'm straight down the middle. It gives War of the Gargantuas 4.2. So, yeah. I think that's a pretty fair assessment, 4.2. I mean, there's a little less variation this time with, you know, being the only guest. But I think, you know, together with the audience feedback, it bears out that it is a really good film. And if you haven't seen it, and again, if you haven't, why the hell are you listening to this until you've watched it? Go and see it.
Yeah, it's not for everyone. Let's be honest about that. It is one of those that isn't for everyone. But if you like kaiju films, or if you just like that whole Japanese genre in general, you've got to give this a go. You've got to.
Yeah. I mean, it does seem to be one of those, I guess, hidden little gems that you do hope more will discover. And, you know, if this show at least brings it to the attention, as you mentioned, of more people will think, I'll give that a go. You know, they'll give it a try.
Yeah, then that's we've done his job sort of thing if that happens.
Exactly. So, yeah, that's it for this episode, folks. We hope you found it both interesting and entertaining. If so, I've certainly enjoyed discussing this one with my guests. So thank you to Nige, the Kaiju Whisperer, for joining me today.
My pleasure, DK. Thank you for inviting me again.
Not a problem. How was it for you? All right?
Loved it. I love all these.
Nice one. Well, I understand you're coming again later this year, isn't that right?
I believe so. If I'm invited, I shall be there.
Definitely. We may not have covered him this time around, but on the 70th anniversary of his first appearance, it would just be rude not to take a look at the original King of the Monsters. So Nige will be back with both Mike and myself this October as we take a look at the original Godzilla, or Gojira, if you prefer. So are you looking forward to that one, fella?
Absolutely. It's just, again, it's another one of those films that you have to watch it.
Definitely. While you're here, is there anything that you want to plug? Any social media, any projects that you've got working on? Or
no. All I've done for the last 7 months is work.
Oof. Yeah, thank you once again to Nigel. And thank you again to you out there for pulling up a chair with us for this one. If you've had a good time, please consider dropping us a tip in our Ko-fi account, link in the description. Not that we do it for the money, but it is always a bonus. And don't forget to like, subscribe, and share. And hey, if you're up for chatting to like-minded movie nerds, then come and join us on our Facebook group. Again, link in the description. We'll be back next month, puzzle box in hand, as we take a look at Clive Barker's Hellraiser. And if you're familiar with that particular mythos, we'll be joined by a very special guest, so don't miss it. In the meantime, thank you for your company. It's been a pleasure. And until next time, remember, with just one look into your face, my mind starts to drift right into space. Well, you know the rest. Adios, folks.
You have been listening to the Cult Classics Show, part of the Silver Screen Podcast, created, written, and hosted by DK. Produced by Mike Wilson. Editing by Nick. Feedback section produced by Lady VN. Opening credits by Ian Sanderson. Music by Timeless Journey. Follow us on social media. Links to all of our social media pages can be found on our link tree. This podcast is part of the Mike's Podcast Network, available wherever you get your podcasts. Just search for Silver Screen Podcast or Mike's Podcasts. And don't forget to like, subscribe, and share. Thank you for joining us. We hope to see you next time. And remember, no matter where you go, there you are.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.